Now on the finest, Ahmed Judeh first found ballet as a stateless refugee in Syria on the cusp of war. Today, he dances in San Diego's Golden State Ballet. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome in San Diego, it's Jade Hindman. On today's show, we examine Trump's policies 1 year into his second term, plus tens of thousands of people across the nation are walking away from their daily activities and into the streets to protest Trump's policies. This is KPBS Midday Edition, connecting our communities through conversation. Today marks 1 year since President Trump returned to office. Experts agree his first term was largely unpredictable, but his second term has been marked by an even greater sense of volatility, unprecedented action, and seismic shifts in both domestic and foreign policy. Joining me now is Casey Dominguez, professor of political science and international relations at the University of San Diego. Professor Dominguez, welcome back to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you on. In a word or two, how would you describe the last year in politics?
Radically different.
Yes. I mean, how would you differentiate his first term from his second? What's the biggest change in his approach to policy and governing?
Well, I think in the first term, the people that joined his administration tended to come from standard Republican circles, people who had served in the Bush administration, people who had long careers in Republican politics. And so there was some stability and continuity that came from that. And I think in his second term, he has been more careful to populate his administration, not with people who were loyal to the old Republican Party, but people who are loyal to the Trump Republican Party. And so there's less pushback from the people in the government to whatever it is that Donald Trump wants to do.
What's the consequence?
Well, in the news this week, we're talking about invading Greenland, and that's just not something that would have ever come up under a previous Republican administration. So I think there's more dependence on the personal preferences and whims of Donald Trump, the man, than we have seen in the institutional presidency prior to this.
Also, here in San Diego and across the country, a lot of attention is on immigration. Trump promised to launch the largest deportation operation in American history, and he kicked off a White House press briefing today by defending his immigration policies. How have his policies compared to his campaign promises?
Well, as you said, he promised mass deportations. To the degree that he promised mass deportations using the military and the police, you know, he always implied that the people that he would be deporting would be the hardened criminals, whether he said that or whether he implied it or encouraged people to believe that based on racist assumptions about immigrants. He has been delivering on mass deportations from the interior of the country. Maybe not the numbers that he had originally suggested, although ICE has a great big budget now, and bigger numbers could be coming. But to get those numbers, he's been deporting people that generally or that disproportionately compared to those that had been previously deported, don't have criminal convictions or have very, very minor criminal infractions. What we're seeing in Minneapolis is, real occupation of immigrant communities to try to find those people that might be undocumented, but have otherwise been just living, the 11 million people that have just been kind of living and working and existing in American society.
Do you have any sense of like what the numbers are? I mean, when we're talking about people who have some criminal record versus those who don't, who are still pulled off the street by ICE and detained and so on.
Yeah, well, the New York Times did a piece this week about on the 18th, and they've got, I think, probably the best numbers that we can get. You know, ICE releases some of these numbers, so we're talking about a monthly rate of deportations of people with no criminal record, 2,100 people per month that are being deported with no criminal record, compared to 1,100 people per month being deported who have a past violent conviction. And so that's, you know, that's a big discrepancy, and it's quite different from what we saw under, say, Joe Biden.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think ICE is going after? What gets to the bottom of these policies, you think? What is this rooted in?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump, since he came on the political stage, has been anti-immigration, and particularly against undocumented immigration. But there's people in his administration, like Stephen Miller, that are avowedly, against legal immigration. And in fact, his administration has made it much more difficult to immigrate legally. And they've been, picking up people who have who are, at their green card interviews and putting them into deportation proceedings. And so, there's some combination of very populist politics about getting deporting people who are undocumented but also dangerous, and the conflation of the very small number of, relatively speaking, small number of dangerously criminal people who are undocumented with the very, very large number of people that are undocumented and are just, living and working. And so, that's the that's what they want to do, is go after anyone who's undocumented, and that's just really different from the priorities of previous administrations.
And it seems there's a target on black and brown communities.
Well, for sure. Immigration enforcement is showing up at people's schools, at churches, at courts, places, places where people work. And many non-white U.S. citizens now have to routinely carry their passports so they can prove their citizenship if they're stopped. And that effectively confers a kind of second-class citizenship on anyone that might be suspected by ICE of, not being an American. And that's a deliberate policy of the administration.
Speaking of other policies, earlier you mentioned Trump's threats to invade Greenland. In the past year, he's largely broken from foreign policy tradition. What stands out to you about his policy approach now compared to his first term?
I think the difference is a willingness to be more aggressive internationally. Trump in his first term was not did not have per any particular aggressive stance. There was one assassination of a high-ranking Iranian official, and some other extensions of actions abroad against terrorist groups in parts of in Iraq and in the Middle East in ways that other presidents have also been engaging in, at least quasi-legally. But his interest in the second term seems more 19th century. It seems more, the 20th century has been characterized by, or was characterized by, the post-war international order that said countries shouldn't attack each other, and shouldn't try to take each other's territory, and shouldn't try to take each other over. And the big break is Trump's willingness to move beyond that, or move backwards, perhaps, toward strong countries get to do what they want, and weak countries just have to live with it.
Well, yeah, and Trump is, really embracing parts of 19th century foreign policy, as you mentioned. He's touting his own approach as the Donroe Doctrine after the infamous Monroe Doctrine. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, The global international order that was set up after World War II, including the United Nations and including NATO, all puts front and center the territorial integrity and the right to sovereignty of people in their own countries and the right to self-determination and not to having, countries invade each other. And the whole UN framework is set up to keep countries from invading each other. And the United States was not always faithful to those rules, but they always, found a way to, with the United States has, even when those rules seem to be bent pretty badly, sort of found a way to say, we are honoring those rules, even though we are taking over the country of Iraq, for example. And Trump just doesn't pay any lip service at all to international law. He said to a reporter a week or two ago, the only thing that limits his power is his own morality, which is, that's a monarchical way to think. And that is definitely not the way the international order worked or was supposed to work under the last half century.
Yeah. Well, Trump is continuing also to test the limits of international relationships. I mean, he recently mocked European leaders who will be meeting soon to address his threats to invade Greenland. Trump is also set to go to the World Economic Forum later today. What could this mean for NATO and U.S. alliances with other nations?
Well, I'm not an expert on NATO, and I have colleagues who are, so I don't want to, say more about NATO specifically than I'm, qualified to say. But, international agreements are built, or they help to facilitate trust, build trust, and to create stable relationships. And when one actor decides to, pull out of that, maybe not, well, I don't know. I don't know if we're pulling out of NATO, but undermine, the purposes of the agreements, well, then there's less, the other countries in that agreement basically shouldn't trust the United States. They shouldn't necessarily want to share intelligence with the United States. They may not want to believe that the United States would come to their defense from Russia or someone else. And so maybe they want to build up their own militaries. Maybe they want to, disentangle our relationships. Maybe they don't want U.S. troops to have bases in their countries. I mean, there's lots of ways that a collapse of NATO could affect, could have downstream effects that we aren't even sure of.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking ahead to the midterms this fall, what are you watching for and how could the outcome impact Trump's power?
Midterm elections are always a referendum on the president that's in power. And the president's party almost always loses some seats in the midterms. Not always, but almost always. And the things that affect that are the performance of the economy and how popular or unpopular the president is. And the economy is not so bad that should be a big drag on Trump, but his own actions are contributing to unpopularity that should help Democrats win close elections and move more Republicans into vulnerable seats and move more Democrats into safe seats. And so at the margins, if the president is unpopular, it should help Democrats win seats in the House. That's, of course, also affected by which states and how many states continue to re-gerrymander their districts to favor one party or the other, might be affected by court decisions. And it might also be, and that's just the House. The Senate, the margins are very close in both the House and the Senate. The Republicans have 53 seats in the Senate. Democrats have a reasonable chance of picking up two or three seats in the Senate, mm-hmm. but that fourth seat to take over the majority power in the Senate would be a very heavy lift. In a wave election with a very unpopular president, could that happen? You bet. That kind of thing is the kind of thing that happens in midterm elections. Looking at next year, you would think that the president would certainly no longer have a unified control of Congress. He, in all likelihood, the Democrats will control at least one House of Congress, though perhaps not by large majorities and perhaps not the Senate. We'll have to see. That's all depends on what happens this year.
Yeah. Well, Last year, we were talking about whether our democracy is still intact or if this is authoritarianism. So with just about a minute left, how would you answer that question now?
You know, there's a category of government that's at the end of the democratic spectrum and between democracy and authoritarianism called competitive authoritarianism, where there are still elections, but the power of the state is used to rig those elections and to silence and discredit the political opposition. And I think that's very much where we are. The prosecution of the president's political critics, the government pressure to, you know, silence political critics online and on TV, the occupation of an American city, and the accusations that opponents, that people who oppose the president, you know, are unfaithful or you know, domestic terrorists or this kind of thing. All of that is out of the competitive authoritarian playbook. So I think that's where we are at the national level.
I've been speaking with Casey Dominguez, professor of political science and international relations at the University of San Diego. Professor, thanks as always.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Up next, tens of thousands of people across the nation are walking away from their daily activities and into the streets to protest Trump's policies. KPBS Midday Edition returns after the break.
KPBS Roundtable offers perspectives from those telling San Diego stories. Join us for weekly conversations with reporters and storytellers, adding depth and context to the headlines driving the news in the San Diego region. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. 1 year ago today, Donald Trump was sworn in as President of the United States for the second time. Well, this afternoon, tens of thousands of Americans are expected to participate in walkouts across the country to protest Trump's policies. It's called the Free America Walkout. In San Diego, protesters will march around the county administration building and end with a rally on the corner of Harbor and Ash Street. Joining me to talk about it is Lisa Dahl. She organized the Free America Walkout in San Diego. And Lisa, welcome to you.
Hi, happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. So as I mentioned, this is a nationwide walkout. What are some of the key demands here?
Yes, there's three demands. It is to shut down billionaires, shut down fascists, and shut down polluters, defend Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm. And what would that look like to you?
Well, starting with the walkout itself, the way it was designed is at being 2 p.m. local time, that everybody walks out from their place of business, school, any activities that they are doing, and they are to not buy anything. And we are doing this to hopefully make a statement with the pocketbook and shut down the economy.
Mm. So I understand this is your first time organizing a protest. What compelled you to take action?
I saw that there were no other organized protests for the Free America Walkout, specifically in San Diego. And I felt that I want to use my privilege to be able to be the voice of minorities and underserved to help speak on their behalf. I also, being a female, I wanted to take on a more leadership role, as well as I have three daughters myself, and I want them to have a better future in America. So this is also for them.
Mm. You know, I mean, a walkout is a purposeful disruption, really, of everyday work and school. Why choose that approach for this?
Yes. So the best way to really get to the heart of our issues and stop billionaires is to stop putting money in their banks. So by shutting down the economy, we are no longer funding them or using our tax dollars for their own benefit of tax breaks. Specifically, last year ago, on January 20th for the inauguration, the first row was all billionaires. It was Musk, Zuckerberg, and Bezos. And that is really giving us a statement here of we are in support of these billionaires who really get the highest tax breaks. So our tax dollars are helping to fund their businesses, as well as any type of tax dollars for things like ICE and any other causes that we are seeing happen to the United States right now are being funded by us, the people. So by shutting down the economy, we are hoping to disrupt all of that.
And, you know, protests are made up of a wide coalition of folks, many of whom are motivated by different issues. What are the key issues mobilizing you to get out and protest?
Specifically, close to my heart, I've been in the healthcare field for 25 years, and $1 trillion is being cut from Medicaid for our population that needs healthcare the most. In San Diego County, there's about going to be a cut of about $300 million cut to Medicaid, which will affect us greatly here in our own community. People will die because they will not be able to get the health care they need. So that, as well as I think it is a right of Americans to have at least some basic healthcare coverage and also have coverage for childcare services. In all 50 states, it costs more for parents to pay for childcare than it does rent. And 55% of parents go into debt paying for childcare.
Well, you know, I've seen many protests over the past year, but tell me about the choice to hold this one now on the anniversary of Trump's second inauguration.
Yeah, that does really go back to my previous point of this, that we in our society have looked at billionaires as something to be admired. And while they are just continuing to take all of the wealth of this nation and use it for their own benefit. So by having those three billionaires front and center at the inauguration just shows that this administration supports those type of people. And the inequality that is happening, as I've mentioned, with healthcare costs, childcare costs, basic living and rent, most of us Americans are just fighting for basic living wage while these billionaires get all of the tax cuts from all of us working, either very low paid labor or for many women in America, a lot of unpaid labor as well.
Let me just ask you this. Is there anything inherently wrong with being a billionaire?
Personally, I think it's a moral issue that they will have more wealth that they will ever know what to use or spend in their entire lifetime, or probably their generations to come lifetime, when we in America need to have more equal benefits across the board. And that only continues to lift up the entire nation when all of us can have basic healthcare rights, childcare support, basic living wages, then we all benefit from that. We have a healthier, more prosperous nation. So there is no reason for that amount of wealth to be held by 8 billionaires, I believe, in this entire world.
Mm. So then, in your view, what kind of power does protest have to enact meaningful change here?
Well, we as a democracy are supposed to be having a government and political offices that are for the people. And I don't see that in any way, shape, or form that is happening today. So we are coming together with our collective voices, because there's many more of us than in the government or even the billionaires today, that we should be sharing our voice to make a change and really express how we want our future to look like, whether it be in government or, you know, our living wages, rent. All of that should be based on us, the people, the democracy, of how we want the future to be. And right now, it's not being run that way. It is in solely of support of these billionaires and their desires.
I've been speaking with Lisa Dole. She organized the Free America Walkout in Protest, which will happen this afternoon at Waterfront Park. Lisa, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
It's hard to ignore that childhood has changed in a lot of ways. And one of the most striking reasons is the role technology is playing in it. From the NPR Network and KPBS, this is Screen Time, a podcast featuring conversations about technology and kids in today's digital age. Listen to Screen Time wherever you get your podcasts.